This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Congress is debating the future of many federally funded programs. House Speaker Newt Gingrich has called for abolishing the National Endowment for the Arts, a federally funded program which provides grants to artists and arts groups. My first guest in this half hour, Lynn Munson, says it's time to dismantle the NEA. Munson is a research associate at the think tank the American Enterprise Institute. For 2 years, she worked at the National Endowment for the Humanities as special assistant to Director Lynn Cheney, who was appointed by President Bush. Munson told me why she's in favor of abolishing the NEA.
Well, I think for the reasons that are most obvious. I mean, when we're cutting subsidies for farmers, when we're cutting subsidies for welfare mothers, and we should be doing all of these things because of the horrible budget deficit we're in, there's really no possible way we can justify further subsidies for the cultural elite.
What does cultural elite mean? Who are we talking about?
Well, it is, of course, a hard group to define. I think that with respect to the arts and the humanities endowments, and I should actually keep my remarks, of course, to the arts endowment, that's the focus of your show, that what it means are the elites of the art world, the people who get their works put on display and wonderfully reviewed in places like the New York Times, the people who have their work up in Soho and elsewhere, and do very well in terms of getting, reviewed by the mainstream art critics and art culture.
Now, I know you worked at the National Endowment for the Humanities in the chairman's office for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Were you opposed to the NEH at the time that you worked there?
Well, I was trying to play my part, as I think as was Lynn Cheney, who was the chairman at the time, in trying to do the best job we could in running a government agency very responsibly, and I think Lynn Cheney made the most courageous effort to do so. But I think that, if anything, my time at the NEH is what has most, informed my opinion in these matters now.
What did you see there or what happened there that reinforced your point of view that the government shouldn't be supporting the arts or humanities?
There's no doubt that the NEH is sponsored to many great products, but I think that these are things that could have found life without the NEH. As a matter of fact, I think it does a great disservice to scholars in America, to people who work on public projects like films and things of that sort, museum exhibitions, to say that these things would not exist if it wasn't for government subsidy.
Is there anything else that you saw during your 2 years at the NEH that made you even more opposed to federal funding for arts and humanities?
Well, in fact, there was. I mean, I think there's a real incidence of intellectual fraud going on as a result of government funding. I don't know if perhaps this happens in foundations, too, where someone, a scholar perhaps, submits an application to do X, and a couple years later when you get the final report back on the project, you see that they've actually done Y with your monies. Of course, when you're talking about federal taxpayer money, this becomes a real problem to worry about. Something that's in the news right now is a perfect example of this. A few years ago, when Lynn Cheney was chairman of the NEH, she gave a grant to the History Center out at UCLA to produce history standards. Well, the history standards were recently delivered a couple years, like I said, maybe 3 years after she'd given the original grant, and funding, of course, had been provided since then. The history standards are not what they promised to be. They promised to be a very balanced, objective, fair portrayal of American and world history. They ended up being quite otherwise. They tell a grim and gloomy story of America's history, focusing only on the things that we've done wrong and not at all on any of the things we've done right. And they, in fact, downplay every American hero that we've ever had, everyone from scientists to major political figures. They, for example, never tell us that George Washington was our first president. They never mention Thomas Edison, Einstein, or the Wright brothers. And there's very little you can do about it.
Just getting back to the issue of does the NEA serve the cultural elite, do you think that by some standards you would be considered yourself part of a cultural elite? You're an educated person, you've served on the NEH, you're a person who has done, I assume, works of scholarship as well as had important input into government affairs.
Mm. Well, I don't know, actually. I think of myself as someone who's, if anything, an up-and-coming member of the cultural elite. I think I've yet to fully earn my place as a member of the cultural elite, and it's not exactly something I'm striving for. But when I say cultural elite, what I'm referring to is definitely something from which I would exclude myself, in that it involves being, it's so hard to define, but I think it involves being invested in an orthodoxy, which has become a way of thinking about our cultural in America that plays according to a very specific cultural and political agenda. And any deviation from that agenda automatically casts you out as a member of the cultural elite. What I'm talking about is this difference I was speaking to, I think, earlier, about how there are representational artists who I know who will not even apply to the Arts Endowment for funding because they know their work will not just not be treated fairly, but not taken seriously in the least. There's a very well-known representational artist by the name of Philip Perlstein, who wrote an article some years ago, I believe in a publication of the College Art Association, talking about his experience in serving on a panel at the Arts Endowment. He showed up to find out that, and it was a visual arts panel, that all of the slides of work submitted by artists who worked in a figurative or in any way representational style had been culled out of the group that they were to review on the panel for funding. These were simply not considered serious enough, important enough, for consideration by the full panel. Mr. Perlstein talks in his article about having spent many hours on his own going through all the slides that had been taken out, putting them back into the group to be considered because he felt that they had been inappropriately removed from consideration.
You are, I believe, accusing the NEA of funding only what fits its orthodoxy of what good art is. And many people in the arts community say that the people who are attacking them have a different orthodoxy about what art is and what art shouldn't be and what art shouldn't address.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think both sides are hearing each other?
Well, I don't know whether or not both sides are hearing each other, but I know that our idea of abolishing the Arts Endowment certainly takes the problem off the table. I think abolishing the Arts Endowment would give us the opportunity to remove any hope for an orthodoxy to influence government funding for the arts, which I think is a very good thing.
Lynn Munson is a research associate at the American Enterprise Institute. Paul Goldberger speaks in favor of federal funding for the arts after a break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Goldberger is chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times and the Times' former architecture critic and cultural news editor. He supports continued federal funding of the arts. But he says that the arts community, in trying to save the NEA, feels forced to represent the arts as sweet and lovable, not merely good, but good for you.
Right now, the arts lobby is in a terrible bind because they can either admit that art is difficult, that art exists in part to upend social values and thus risk even more wrath from the right, or they can try to fight the right with this one argument they have in their arsenal, which is to say art isn't just Mapplethorpe, it isn't just sort of weird, crazy, difficult stuff, it's all this nice, lovable stuff too, and it's the NEA helping some dance group in the middle of North Dakota, which would otherwise have no access to art or to culture in any way. And of course, all of that is true. I was just trying to take one step back and look at the broader picture and say, God, isn't it absurd that it has come to this, that in this country where we give a piddling amount to art anyway, we can get away with even that tiny amount only by pretending that it's trivial, sweet stuff.
Opponents of the NEA argue that if the arts are worth anything, they should be self-supporting as well. Do you buy that argument?
I don't think the arts have ever historically been self-supporting in any culture, in any society. I mean, Michelangelo was commissioned by the popes. The Medicis and other great patrons throughout history have paid the bill for art. Very rarely has the public been able to pay the bill through, you know, the conventional market economy.
But let me ask you a tough question. With benefits to people on welfare likely to be cut, how do you justify saving money for the arts?
By the same reasoning that led Winston Churchill to increase rather than decrease art subsidies in England at the height of World War II, when things were far more desperate than they are in this country right now, because he knew that quality of life and meaning of life were important at critical times, and that by investing in culture, by investing in the impact that culture can have on human life, on some sense of meaning, of spirituality even, in life, that those are investments that pay off in long-term and profound ways.
As an architecture critic, you've written a lot about the life of cities.
Mm-hmm.
One of the arguments being made to save the NEA is that arts institutions have great economic payoffs for city life. You know, the people go to the theater, they eat at a restaurant. People go to a concert, they come into town. You know, Lincoln Center is a real big tourist attraction in New York, so you're getting people from out of town into town. People into town, you're getting them to restaurants and to shops nearby. As someone who's really studied the life of cities, how much validity do you put in that argument?
Tremendous validity. In fact, the only real tangible benefit we can point to from the arts is, in fact, economic in this way. All the other benefits, the improving the quality of the sense of meaning in life that I referred to a moment ago, are intangible things that we can never measure in a hard way. But this one we can measure, and in fact, every study, every survey all over the country has proven that arts dollars are tremendously efficient recycling through the economy. They do amazing things. You invest a dollar in a concert or an opera subsidy, and that pulls crowds into Lincoln Center or into the Academy of Music in Philadelphia or what have you, and those crowds go to restaurants. Sometimes they come from out of town and stay in hotels. They do all kinds of things that keep all kinds of people in the urban economy busy.
Critics of the NEA say that the NEA is inherently elitist, that it supports a cultural elite. And I think the perception is that that cultural elite lives largely in big coastal cities. What do you think?
I think it's nonsense. I think it's true that there is more art and more culture in big coastal cities, or big cities in general, as has historically been true all over the world in every country, that art and culture gravitate toward large economic and population centers which can support it better, where there are more audiences available. You'd be very unlikely to be able to support, you know, an opera performance every night in Butte, Montana. That more of it exists in the cities is as history has always been, and no different here than anywhere else in the world. And the only difference between our country and the rest of the world there is that we seem to think there's something weird about it, because we've always been so oddly suspicious of our cities, unlike every other country in the world, which seems to look at its largest cities with pride rather than this kind of hatred that we feel in this country for it. So that's the first part, the answer to the second part of your question. The first part, the question of elitism, I think is much more difficult and much more troubling, because it comes down really to a fundamental suspicion about the role of art and culture in general. We tend in this country to have a profoundly anti-intellectual bias, and to believe that there's something slightly suspicious about the arts. I think there is still, even at this late moment in our history, this belief on the part of many Americans that, you know, if somebody earns a living writing or acting or playing music, you know, why don't they sort of get a real job? What is all this about? And this argument about elitism stems in large part from that feeling, which is rarely articulated as bluntly as I just have done, but somehow hovers over that argument or hides underneath it. The truth is, of course, NEA subsidies are not that elitist. And as Jane Alexander has argued tirelessly in the last few years, if the NEA has done anything, it's spread money around and make art less elitist. So there's another paradox to this whole situation, which is as the NEA spends more and more money to subsidize arts groups all around the country and bring art and culture to more and more communities all around the country that might not have been exposed to it, it's getting attacked as being elitist.
My guest is Paul Goldberger, chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back with us in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We've heard from several people today on both sides of the debate over federal funding for the arts. Our final guest, Paul Goldberger, is chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times. The last time around when the NEA was at the center of controversy, the argument against the NEA was pinned to controversial art, art that was considered sacrilegious and sexually perverse.
Yes.
Now the debate seems to have shifted to something more abstract, the federal role in funding of the arts. And I'm wondering what you think the debate is really about, if you think that there's a subtext underneath what's actually being addressed.
I think the debate of a couple of years ago has never fully ended. I think Jane Alexander has been very effective in going around the country trying to mute that old debate and shift things back toward the basic level of the goodness of federal art subsidies, and reminding everyone that it isn't all art that is viewed as sexually perverse or representing inappropriate values, that a tremendous amount of what the NEA supports is sort of, chicken soup. It's just fine. It's apple pie. She's been a very effective, articulate proponent of that view. However, I think the far right is not terribly convinced, but they know that they cannot completely contradict her. So they have moved with her to the sort of more central battleground of trying to simply get rid of the whole thing. Saying that there's no real important role for federal subsidies, period. This is just not the federal government's business. You can say that all you want. I don't think I'll ever be convinced that the right isn't still trying to purge this country of either sexually explicit or provocative or politically radical art. In the end, this is about an amount of money that is so tiny, it's a fly speck in the federal budget, that there has to be some other political agenda at work, or why would anyone care? I mean, it's, you know, the Defense Department spends more in 5 minutes than the National Endowment does in a year. It has nothing to do with the federal deficit. It's too tiny an amount of money.
If federal funds to the arts are cut or eliminated, what effect do you think that would finally have on the arts?
You know, it would be devastating in certain cases, and to be perfectly frank, in others, I shouldn't say this because I don't want to give any ammunition to opponents of art subsidies, but in fact, you know, art will go on. It will not be the end of the world. It will stop. But an awful lot of very talented people who operate at the edge may fall off the edge, and that's what I fear most. I mean, Lincoln Center will go on. The Metropolitan Opera will not close down. They don't rise or fall on the NEA. What does are smaller institutions and outlying communities and individual artists of talent, many of whom have no other source of funds. And in the case of small institutions, very often the NEA is a validating tool, a legitimizing tool that has made other money possible. A grant from the NEA says to everyone that a small dance company in the middle of South Dakota is okay. We've checked it out. Our professionals have evaluated it, and these people are serious and they know what they're doing. And that validation, in turn, has often made other money possible.
What message do you think it would send if Congress cuts off funds for the NEA?
If Congress cuts off funds for the NEA, no matter how it's masked, no matter what anybody says about the proper role of the federal government, it will send the message today that the arguments put forth by the right a few years ago, when the debate over sexually explicit and subversive art was at its height, it will send the message that that debate still controls the agenda, and that the arguments made a few years ago ultimately still carry the day. And that's my greatest concern, that no matter how the whole thing is masked, no matter what new arguments are put forth, in the end, this will still be the right getting back at art it doesn't like.
Paul Goldberger is chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times.